Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dan Bornstein, columnist and editorial writer for the Contra Costa Times. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Tom Campbell, professor of business and former dean of Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, and an economic advisor to the international law firm Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. Tom Campbell has a long and very impressive resume. He clerked for the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Byron White, graduated magna cum laude from Harvard Law School in 1976, where he served on the board of editors for Harvard Law Review, and earned a Ph.D. in economics from the University of Chicago in 1980. From 1981 to 1983, Campbell served as director of the Bureau of Competition at the Federal Trade Commission, where he directed 180 attorneys. From 1983 to 2002, he served as a law professor at Stanford University. Tom's career in a public service began in 1989 when he served two terms as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives for California's 12th Congressional District. He was elected to the California State Senate in 1993 and served until 1995. He was then elected again to the U.S. House, representing California's 15th District from 1995 to 2001. He has served since 2004 on the Council of Economic Advisors to California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and was the director of California's Director of Finance and was the director of California's Department of Finance from 2004 to 2005. In his talk today, Tom will discuss the national economy, the national bailout plan, and the state of California and the state of the California bailout plan. Please welcome Tom Campbell.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much, Dan. I'm so happy to be back home, and I'm really proud of the Commonwealth Club for having meetings in the East Bay to complement those in San Francisco. And, of course, the East Bay is the home of the California Golden Bears. Go Bears! And that, I have the following topics tonight to include in my prepared remarks, and I look forward to your questions and a conversation that we might have. I'll speak about what I know of the federal stimulus bill. I'll speak about an estimate of the current economic recession. On that point, everyone should have at her or his place a handout. And the reason is that you don't have to worry about writing down any numbers. I also have the websites for where those numbers can be updated, so it might be a useful thing for you to keep. And that's why I have it there. But I probably won't be referring to the document itself, except in text, which I will explain. I'll then make some comments about the bright points. So I thought I would distinguish myself by saying a few good things about the potential for a turnaround in the economy, and we ought to try to feel good at least. And then take a quick word or two on how we got where we are. Closing off then with a discussion of California, we have today a pretty good rumor that there will be a budget deal this week, and I'd like to talk to you about what I hear. Let's begin with the stimulus bill. We're told, and I haven't seen it, forgive me, I'm not here to be political. I should have said it at the start. I will do my very best not to be partisan or political. There's plenty of praise for both parties to go around. From what I hear, the stimulus bill this was the White House press release this afternoon, one-third for job creation, one-third for tax cuts, and one-third transfers to the states. That, however, is not how an economist would look at it. An economist would look at it by saying how much to stimulate investment and how much to stimulate consumption. And that's important because my whole take on this, and I invite your comments and debate, but my whole take is to get out of a recession, you need investment. Think about it for a moment. Last summer, we had the $160 billion rebate checks under President George W. Bush. And President Bush proposed $160 billion in rebate checks. Out they went, and the economy didn't appear to change at all. So the danger is that if all you do is give money to consumption, people will indeed spend it. It'll be a one-time burst. But no employer will hire somebody on the basis of selling the goods that are purchased on a one-time burst. So it's important, therefore, to try to distinguish what's investment from what's consumption. With that in mind, I've done my calculation, but this is incomplete since I was working off two drafts, the Senate bill and the House bill. But I think it's going to be within a standard deviation of right. And that's not bad for an economist. The transfers on a $789 billion bill, the transfers, the consumption total 80%, 80%. And that worries me because so much is in the consumption side. On the investment side, 10%. And then 10% that I really couldn't characterize carefully one way or the other because they are particular projects. And I'm going to quote from this morning's Wall Street Journal. The stimulus package the Senate approved Tuesday may technically be free of earmarks, but it nonetheless includes several provisions that would likely benefit only a handful of specific corporations. So it's another 10%. For example, investment or expenditures, I say I'm uncertain, in a satellite to monitor global warming, to weatherize middle-income homes, to create an electronic border instead of a physical barrier, money for renewable energy. And in that connection, this is my one attempt at being humorous. Quote Rahm Emanuel, who is quoted in the San Francisco Chronicle, in an article in San Francisco Chronicle, December 19th, you never want a serious crisis to go to waste. Namely, when the train is moving out of the station and you've got a caboose, you may as well toss it on. And this is not a fault of this administration exclusively by a long shot. I remember the Hurricane Andrew emergency bill when I was in Congress, which also refurbished a courthouse in Brooklyn, New York. You see the connection with Hurricane Andrew, I'm sure. So that's the present federal stimulus bill has a very small amount for what I think it should have a more amount for, namely investment. Now, what's the consequence? Well, nobody is proposing a tax increase to pay for the $789 billion, and nobody is proposing cutting elsewhere. So the money will be printed, and the Federal Reserve has the authority to print the money. They then use that printed money to buy bonds from the Treasury, U.S. Treasury. The U.S. Treasury prints these bonds just for the Federal Reserve. They're not negotiable. They're just for you. And the Federal Reserve puts them in a vault, and the Treasury gets to spend the money. So it's fair to say that we are going to see $789 billion more printed money. Two important consequences. The first is the size of the budget deficit will rise from $455 billion in 2008 to $1.3 trillion in 2009. As a percentage of the GDP, that is a rise of from 3.2 to 8.8. As a percentage of the – and the total debt of the United States will rise from 10.7 trillion to 12 trillion. As a percentage of the GDP, the total debt will rise from 74% to 82%. Why does that matter? Well, one quick thought, the more of a country's debt that is held overseas, the greater potential political power is given to an adversary who buys that debt. And it is possible that an adversary might threaten the United States' interests by dumping the debt on the market all at one time. The rebuttal to that is, oh, no, the adversary would be silly to do that because it would drop the value of the debt. That's right, but not every country works always in its own best economic interest. I think history is replete with examples where countries worked contrary to their economic interest in order to achieve a political or diplomatic interest. So that's the concern. And then the other part, and all of this data is in your handout, is in order to get a grip on these numbers, I went to the federal budget and found out how much we're paying back of the debt every year. And then I made the following entirely unrealistic assumption. Suppose we didn't borrow another dime after today. Okay? We just stopped. No more borrowing. How long would it take us to pay back what we already owe? 294 years. So that is the issue. issue number one of this amount of expenditure, possibly giving our adversaries in international matters a power against us, and secondly, nobody believes we will pay back this debt. Now, the other side and the second worry is inflation. Eventually, that amount of money will find its way into an increase in the price level. It won't happen while the recession is on, but as soon as people begin to buy goods again, it will show. And roughly speaking, this is just a rough approximation, if you take the $789 billion or $800 billion and divide it by the money supply, $8 trillion, you've got a 10% increase. That means unless there is an increase in GDP, you're going to add to inflation by 10% as soon as the economy starts picking up again. So the base rate of inflation now is about 3%, add 10%, 13%. That is the risk of printing the money. Alternatively, you could cut spending somewhere else or increase taxes. I'm not a fan of increasing taxes because also in the material you will see the incidence of taxation, and this is important for California as well. Many people say all we ought to do is ask the wealthy to pay their fair share. You've heard that expression. So the wealthy, the top 1%, presently pay 36% of the entire U.S. income tax burden. 1% pays 36%. But people come back and say, yes, but 1% make a huge amount of the income in the country. Well, they make 14.3%. So they make 14%, they pay 36%. Top 5% pay 56% of all income tax in the United States, and they earn 26%. So I don't know where you get the argument about fairness. It's a difficult argument, I think, to make in face of those statistics. How long will the recession last? The best way to estimate this is to take a look at recent other recessions, and that would be 80 to 82 and 91 to 92. And I did that, and based on GDP, unemployment numbers, unemployment percentages, and the stock market, there's a rough coalescing around 2 years and a quarter, 2 years and a quarter, which would put us at the end of 2010. So from the previous recessions, that's what you would expect. And, of course, it could be different from the previous recessions, but I think that there's something psychology teaches us here. Getting out of a recession is oftentimes a matter of psychology as much as it is economics. When people believe that the economy is coming back, they'll buy, the prices won't fall anymore, they may as well buy now, and employers will start to hire. And that psychology has run in all of the previous post-war recessions two years and a quarter at its worst. And then occasionally we've had more mild recessions, but this is not going to be a mild one. How bad is it compared with others? Again, compared by GDP, we've lost a half a percentage point in the third quarter. The preliminary estimates are about 3 percentage points in the fourth quarter. So let's say 3%. That compares with the first term of Ronald Reagan, President Ronald Reagan. Think back, and in the fourth quarter of 1981, the economy dropped 4.9%. First quarter of 82, 6.4%. Then the other recessions, first quarter of 1991, we had a 2% drop. And in the third quarter of 2000, with the dot-com bust upon us, a 1.4% drop. So we are not yet at the worst. Is one pessimistic way of looking at it, or an optimistic way of looking at it is we've survived worse. We've been through worse. That also holds up when you look at the employment numbers and the unemployment percentages. The one point where we're clearly worse than previous post-war recessions is the rapidity of the drop in the stock market. So the stock market went down a lot faster this time and steeper than it has at any other recession in the post-World War II period. It's been a 55% drop. The bear market began in October of 07. The only comparable times were a 47% drop at the time of the Nixon-Ford handover and a 47% drop once again at the time of the tech bubble. Are there any bright spots? Yes, there are bright spots. Let's talk about them. First of all, the price of oil, petroleum, is falling. The price at the pump goes up and down, and it isn't perfectly matched. There are bottlenecks to explain that. But a fundamental thought is this. If you look at the price at the pump now, $2.25 when I filled up last night in the Bay Area, nationally $2.05, and compare that with last summer in June, it was $4.25. and 6 cents nationally. The difference between $4.06 and the $2.25 is worth more than the entire stimulus package under President George Bush, the $160 billion rebate checks. So the commodity prices are that most affect us are petroleum, gas, and it is dropping substantially lower. That's like an infusion of cash just as much as in the bill that I previously described. Productivity. Productivity is output per worker. This dropped during the recessions under President Reagan. It's holding. It's positive, even in the present recession, which is to say we have such an effective use of capital with labor, we haven't yet run it out. We haven't yet exhausted the value of the technological revolution, and that's holding. Very positive sign. Third development, we have an accommodating monetary policy. Does the word drunken sailor spring to mind? You want low interest rates? I'll give you low interest. I'll give you negative interest rates. I'll give you money if you want to borrow. So the Federal Reserve has made it clear they'll lower interest rates as low as they possibly can till they are actually below the inflation rate, which they presently are. And this contrasts with the recession under President Reagan, where we had a very tight money policy because Paul Volcker was attempting to undo all of the inflation from the previous 6 years. So we have an accommodating monetary policy. We had a tight one under President Reagan. We got through the recession President Reagan in 2 years and a quarter. We should, therefore, be doing on that benchmark at least as well and getting out of it at least as well. And the last positive, which you may not have thought I would call a positive, is home prices. What do you mean? How could home prices be a positive? Well, clearly home prices are dropping and have been a drop in the element of the GDP. The GDP is broken down into investment and consumption, and one of the investment areas is homes. And that's clear that that's been dropping. But here's the interesting thing. Once more, it's in your material, but I'm put it in the form of a question. If you bought a $500,000 home in 1993, on average, it would have been valued at $650,000 at the turn of the century. Now, if that same rate of growth continued, it would be worth $875,000 today. But instead, it's actually worth $1,146,000 today. So what's the problem? The answer is that in June of 2006, it was worth $1.5 million. So here's the interesting problem, and here why I could actually look at it as a positive. Yes, home prices have dropped, but they have still run up so much faster than inflation. We are at 150, if 2000 was 100, on average home prices in America today. And if you compounded the inflation rate from the turn of the century to now, they would be at 123. And the killer, the fact that we are feeling bad about it, is that at one time they had tripled in value, and now they've only doubled in value. Now, why is that a good economic thing? Well, there's two aspects of the housing value. One is people who take value out of their houses by getting a loan and spending it. That's at an end. That's not happening. That's the negative. But on the other is the long-term homeowner, the person who buys and holds the home. That person's wealth is stronger than it was at the turn of the century, stronger than if they put it in inflation. It is a good investment, and it continues to be a good investment despite the downturn in home values. And lastly, when you look at the numbers that I distributed, you'll find that the home price depression is a localized phenomenon. It is not the same throughout the country. In fact, the drop in home prices from the peak to the trough, June 2006 being the peak, is 2.7% in Dallas. They never had the boom, so they never had the bust. And in New York, it's 11.9%, Chicago 13%. And then you have San Francisco, Bay Area, 36%. Feel good. We could be Las Vegas at 39.5. So those are the positives, and they're not trivial. Productivity's up. Oil prices are down. Accommodating monetary policy. And the aspect of value that you have in your home, despite the recent drop, is still better than inflation and preserves its value. How did we get to this present situation? This is a topic for a meeting all on its own. But let me quote from Russell Roberts in a Wall Street Journal article. Beginning in 1992, Congress pushed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to increase their purchases of mortgages going to low and moderate income borrowers. For 1996, the Department of Housing and Urban Development gave those agencies an explicit target. 42% of their mortgage financing had to go to borrowers with incomes below the median in their area. So it was government policy. This was not accidental. Freddie and Fannie were told, go out there and buy mortgages that are at the risky side. And this has both Democratic and Republican fingerprints on it. Again, I'm not here to make a partisan point. Notice that the target was given in 1996. It was increased to 50%. So it's 42 in 1996. That target was increased to 50% in 2000 and 52% in 2005. So you see Democratic and Republican presidents. There's, however, a special action that the Congress took, and I want to emphasize this because it doesn't get the attention it deserves. Congress regulates in a very unusual way. In order to get more funding for low-income housing, but not show up as an expenditure that would be a budget balance problem, or be subject to what was once called the pay-as-you-go rule, that if you increase expenditure, you had to cut it somewhere else. The House and the Senate banking committees would call in Freddie and Fannie's presidents and say, we want you to lend more readily, take a bigger risk. They would do so. Lower-income people who didn't previously have access to housing got access to housing, and it never showed up on the budget. It was a way of accomplishing a political objective, a policy objective, I don't mean to put it down, which with people could agree or disagree. But to me, the honest way of doing that is to say, I wish to spend $103.7 million to help low-income housing. Who's going to vote yes? Who's going to vote no? You have it on the record, and you know how much it's going to cost. What was less than honest, that's what I mean to say, so I'll say it, less than honest, is to tell Freddie and Fannie, you do it, you go to the edge. This quote is from Barney Frank, September 10th, 2003. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have played a very useful role in helping make housing more affordable, both in general through leveraging the mortgage market, and in particular, they have a mission that this Congress has given them in return for some of the arrangements which are of some benefit to them, the mission to focus on affordable housing. I believe that we, as the federal government, have probably done too little rather than too much to push them to meet the goals of affordable housing. The more people, in my judgment, exaggerate a threat of safety and soundness, the more people conjure up the possibility of serious financial losses to the Treasury, which I do not see, the more pressure there is, then the less I think we see in terms of affordable housing, end quote. And the last citation I want to give you on this particular point is what has now become a famous article, at least on the Internet, of September 30th, 1999, New York Times, entitled Fannie Mae Eases Credit to Aid Mortgage Lending. Fannie Mae Corporation is easing the credit requirements on loans that it will purchase from banks and lenders. In moving even tentatively into this new area of lending, Fannie Mae is taking on significantly more risk, which may not pose any difficulties during flush economic times, but the government-subsidized corporation may run into trouble in an economic downturn, prompting a government rescue similar to that of the savings and loan industry in the 1980s. Quote, from the perspective of many people, including me, this is another thrift industry growing up around us, end quote, said Peter Wallison, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Quote, if they fail, the government will have to step up and bail them out the way it stepped up and bailed out the thrift industry, end quote. It was seen. It was predicted. And the fascinating thing when you go back and read the history is that the political officers in power at the time were proud to take credit for it. Said, yeah, that's what we're doing. We are getting more affordable housing for lower-income people. But the way they were doing it was to tell Freddie and Fannie, look the other way at the margin on whether it's a good credit risk. And the result we saw. We did have to bail out. And the way it worked was something that I've not seen before, but the banks took on mortgage and mortgage-backed securities, which had been purchased by Freddie and Fannie. And they applied the sense that since Freddie and Fannie had bought these securities, they must be good securities. These must be good, valid mortgages. That didn't follow logically. Not if the reason they were buying those mortgages was because they were under pressure from Congress and the administration to do so. But the banks took it, and so did the rating agencies, the Standard & Poor's and Fitch's, that they were good because Freddie and Fannie had bought them. So that's a quick run through of how we got here. Those mortgages ended up then packaged into mortgage-backed securities, rated AAA for a while, put on the books of insurance companies and banks and apparently the entire government of Iceland. And then they turn out not to be worthwhile. But you said they were AAA. Yes, well, that was because Freddie and Fannie bought them. Why did Freddie and Fannie buy them? Oh, I guess it wasn't because they were top quality. Indeed, they were by design not top quality. A few minutes on the California, and then I look forward to your questions. On the California front, the present situation is best to be understood in terms of a historical comparison. And I've not seen this done before. But if you go back to Governor Gray Davis's first budget, and that was $57.8 billion, and you say, let's increase that. That was 1998. Let's increase that for the inflation that's happened since then. And let's increase that for the growth of population in our state since then. The number today would be $89 billion. How much revenue do we have this year? We have 91. How much expenditure? 102. Let me repeat the numbers. We are in deficit this year, $11 billion, and 30 more next year. The reason we're in deficit this year is because we intend to spend 102, and we only have 91. If, however, we had spent the amount Gray Davis's first budget had proposed, increased for inflation and increased for population, we would be spending 89 and have $2 billion to spare. So the opening comment has to be that there is something troublesome about the rate of growth of expenditure in the state of California. Whatever you say about the two-thirds requirement and the revenue side, start with that. It's a start. It's to me a very a troubling number. If I do the same calculation for the state of California that I did for the federal government, how many years to pay back all that we borrowed? The answer is 84 years. So be proud, fellow Californians. We are fiscally responsible compared with Uncle Sam. It's actually remarkable that we can accumulate so much debt since the Constitution of California requires us to balance our budget. I give you the data from the legislative analyst, and here I hope you'll admit a little bit of humor when I point out that the only time when the budget was balanced in recent memory was when I was the director of finance of the state of California. That's not completely true, and I'm not taking credit, but I thought it was a fun thing to say. So if you take a look at the numbers, that happens to be the case. The last time that we were actually in balance was when I was finance director. The short-term solution that appears to be on the docket right now is to increase revenue taxes by increasing the sales tax 1%, by increasing an income tax but an unspecified amount, and by a 12-cent per gallon increase in gas. That will yield about $14 billion. We'll then have about $15 billion in cuts. This is what I heard I called up my old colleagues in the Department of Finance and got some estimates as to what is being talked about right now. So that would be $29 billion. And then the rest is from borrowing for cash flow, which is very dicey. If you borrow for cash flow purposes, you've got to assume you've got the money coming in. Securitizing the lottery revenue. That means pretending that you've got an asset that you're selling once. Once you securitize it, you can't sell it again. That's selling an asset. It's gone. And note also, it's anybody's guess how much you can sell it for. Okay, now, with that background, and I don't know if this deal is final or not, but it appears to be moving towards a resolution, here's the fundamental problem with the California budget. People think there's a constitutional obligation to balance the budget. There isn't. There is only constitutional obligation to pass a budget that the legislature says is balanced. If the legislature wants to, it can be overly optimistic in revenue predictions. So every year the legislature can pretend that there will be a source of revenue. Surely the economy will turn around faster. Surely the capital gains tax that we enjoyed during the dot-com boom will come back as manna. Surely the Indian tribes will give us much more for the slot machines. And that assumption, it's not Democratic or Republican, it's political. It's in the nature of politics. A politician is not by nature a pessimist.
Things are awful. Vote for me.
So you put your best possible face on something, and then you spend on the basis of what might be. And the solution that I would put forward is very simple, and it's not partisan. It should work for Democrats as well as Republicans. And that is that you migrate the state. It's going to take a few years to do this. But you migrate the state financial system to a different approach, whereby instead of estimating what the money will be, spending it, and then hoping that you got your estimate right, take in revenue 1 year and let it earn interest. Don't spend it till the next year. Then we all know what the number is. And then good faith, Democratic and Republican Congress, assembly members and state senators can disagree over what the priority should be. Good faith, they can disagree over whether we should have more revenue by increasing taxes or less, or more revenue by cutting taxes if you're a supply-sider. But there'd be no more budget deficits because you would know the number. And that seems to me the best nonpartisan approach that doesn't demand either side to give up its principles. I'll conclude with my opening remarks then to allow fully half of our time for Q&A with the observation that there ought to be an agreement in the state of California, Democratic and Republican alike, that whatever our priorities may differ and whatever sources of revenue we believe might be appropriate, we do not spend more than we have. That one assumption, that one coalescing, will, I think, do more to restore confidence in our state than any other step that we could take, and a lot of business development and employment will follow as a result. Thank you so much for your attention. I look forward to our dialogue.
Our thanks to Tom Campbell for his comments so far this evening. I'm Dan Bornstein, columnist and editorial writer for the Contra Costa Times. I will be conducting the audience question portion of this program. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Tom Campbell about the economic imperatives for California and the country. Tom, you know the first question everybody wants to know in here is you want to tell us a little bit about your political plans.
Oh, thanks. Mom, thanks you. Nice of you to put that question in there. Under California law, if you spend more than $1,000 for a political purpose that might go to a campaign, you have to establish an exploratory committee. Accordingly, the day I left being dean of the Haas School of Business at Berkeley, I wanted to clean up my political database, having been in office before, and get legal advice as to how I could proceed. The legal advice alone cost more than $1,000. So I immediately formed an exploratory committee, and that is the legal stand where I presently am. Exploratory committee to consider whether I should run for governor. And that's exactly where the legal position is. I've communicated with several friends soliciting their advice, and I continue to solicit that advice.
What do you see as the time frame of what the realistic time frame of what you have to do?
I think in the next month or so, probably that's soon.
Okay. Let's go back.
Maybe I should say one last thing. Comparable to the presidential election at this time in the presidential cycle, Rudy Giuliani and Hillary Clinton were the absolute surefire nominees of both parties.
Let's talk a little bit about the stimulus. This is a question which actually I had too, but one of the audience members had. If you could design a stimulus bill, how big would it be in dollars, and how would you direct the money?
The key is to direct the money to the creation of new jobs. Thus, if you could lower a tax that is presently imposed on creating a new job, that's where it should go. What tax is imposed on creating a new job? FICA, the withholding tax for employment. The problem is if you lower FICA completely across the board, you run the risk that some employers will fire 100 people and hire them back the next day without having to pay FICA. So if I could figure a way to suspend FICA or lower the employment tax for new employees, that would do it. target it directly towards hiring people who are presently unemployed. Since I don't yet have to figure out a way to do it on the FICA tax, the next best would be an investment tax credit. New jobs come when an employer invests. You get an investment tax credit only for net new investment. So that system is already working. We would just make sure we have a bigger boom, a bigger rate of return. A third best would be a capital gains reduction to induce people to invest in such enterprises. Again, going forward, capital gains shall be reduced, for example, to half of its present level for all new investments that start just now. And you don't run the risk then of giving a windfall to those who've already made investments, but you incentivize new investments. That's where it should go. And how much should it be? I'll tell you the truth. I'm troubled at $789 billion because it's 10% of the money supply. That's M2 for those of you know who follow the difference. So it's 10% of the money supply. I think that's high. But if you could direct the 10% of that, the $80 billion, which is in this bill that really does incentivize investment, and put it more towards an investment tax credit as opposed to a particular kind of investment, border maintenance or satellites for global warming, I think you'd get a much better rate of return. So for the sake of argument, to give the questioner an answer, let's do half and let's put it all into investment. That would be a fivefold bigger rate of return, it seems to me, to help us out of this recession than the bill that's likely to be signed.
Okay, following along the same line, Keynes versus Friedman, whose mm-hmm. models of the economy have credibility at this point?
There's only one answer to that question, but I want to be somewhat fair. Milton Friedman was my faculty advisor. I got my PhD in economics at the University of Chicago. There's a little shrine, St. Milton of Friedman. We've kind of incorporated the religion part in this. Milton Friedman, for lack of more refined analysis, brought about the notion of the importance of the money supply and the necessity to have a steady and constrained growth of money lest you have inflation. That was his very good point. John Maynard Keynes identified the lack of demand during the Great Depression and the need for government to come in and supply that demand because individuals were not. Now, at risk of being excommunicated from the Church of St. Milton of Friedman, mm-hmm. I'd say each was right for their time. In the Great Depression, you had no FDIC, you had banks failing, you had people's life savings being wiped out, you had nobody willing to invest. So the government came in and said, we'll do it. And for later times, once we have the FDIC, we have a banking system that has those natural defenses in it, it is critical to get control of the money supply and not see it run. So the correct answer, I think, is for each of their time, they each were geniuses and had a lot to contribute.
Let's stay with the federal issues for a second. How likely are we to end up like Japan, with a decade or two of stagnant growth and no recovery of the stock market?
It's a very serious risk if we don't get the bad assets off the books of the banks. And notice, nothing in this economic recovery bill does that. There's a separate bill that Secretary Geithner is proposing, TARP 2, for lack of a better word. If we don't get the non-performing assets off the bank balance sheets, we are no better than what Japan did. Japan said to its banks, keep those mortgages on your balance sheets, pretend they're performing, we won't force you to write them down. And so the banks limped along, unwilling to make loans because they knew they didn't have the adequate capital, even though they weren't forced to shut down. It's far better to shut down. Bankruptcy does have a valid purpose in an economic downturn. Shut it down, close it off, the assets go to somebody else, let's move again. So the key is not what's in this economic recovery bill. The key is what's in the new bill that Secretary Geithner is working on right now. And here I have a criticism of the predecessor. When the $700 billion TARP bill was passed, the claim that President Bush made on national television and Secretary Paulson made in arguing for it in Congress was that the $700 billion would be used to do just that. It would be used to buy those assets. What's wrong with those assets? No one knows their value. Maybe that mortgage will pay off. Maybe it won't. And besides, there's 100 of them bundled together in this security. I don't know. Therefore, conservative accounting writes it down, or maybe even carries it at zero. Now, if I've got a zero asset, I can't lend. The step that's needed is for the federal government, because it can take the risk, to come in and buy all of the mortgage-backed securities on the books of the banks. And you have to do this all. If you say only those who want to sell, guess what? You'll get the lemons. And the decent ones will be held. You have to do it all. And you're going to have to make your best estimate of what the value is and go out and do it. That is the step that will keep us from being Japan.
So compare it to what we heard from Geithner yesterday, your evaluation of what we heard.
He testified maybe a month before he should have. What he said was, boy, is this a tough problem. and we're working on it. And what might work is to create a bad bank. We got to come up with a better name for that. Invest in the bad bank. It's not a good salesman there. The bad bank will buy the toxic, non-performing mortgage-backed securities, but we want private investors to go halves with us. And then the Federal Reserve and maybe the FDIC, from what I heard yesterday, will insure the private investor's stake in the bad bank. So you take a risk, but part of it is, or at least the major part of it is cushioned by a guarantee from FDIC. What he says is we're still working it out. It's a very difficult problem. And remember, my answer is not elegant. My answer is not mathematically beautiful. My answer is there were 38 cents on the dollar, 38.3 actually. I just made that up. But there's value in having a certain number. Now, here you get 38 cents. Let's go. Instead, you let too much time pass. Dithering may be the right adjective as to what the right value for these are, and they stay on the books. And that was showed in Secretary Geithner's testimony yesterday.
Next question, and it spins off of something you said during your talk. You talked about 13% inflation. Can you elaborate a little bit on what your predictions of what you think we're going to see as the economy recovers in the next few years?
So thank you for asking. The economy recovery, I would predict, beginning late 2010, maybe the end of 2010. When that happens, the amount of increase in the money supply will begin to show up in prices as people begin to buy things again. It doesn't show up before that for a technical reason called the velocity of money. What it means is simply this. You could increase the amount of money but drop like a rock the number of times the money changes hands because people aren't buying things. That's where we are right now. The velocity of money is dropping like a rock. So you can increase the supply of money without it showing up as inflation. But as soon as velocity gets back to its traditional level, that increase in the stock of money is going to show up. It can show up in quantity or price. I know its amount. I know it's a 10% increase, and I know that the present base rate of inflation is about 3%. So that's why I came up with 13. If we are very fortunate, and have a 3% real GDP growth right away, then it'll be 10% inflation. You think we'll have 13% real growth? Outstrip China, India? So the difference is what we'll have in inflation.
Okay, let's put you back in California now for a second. If you were back as finance director, what would you be recommending to Governor Schwarzenegger to balance the budget right now?
I actually did put this in the form of an op-ed because I thought if I was going to run for governor, I should be honest and say what I would do. And this came out around Christmas time. Short-term and long-term. Short-term, for heaven's sakes, get public work starting again. We're in a recession. We need the Caldecott Tunnel expanded. We need 100 important infrastructure projects, north and south, water, transport, highways, ports, airports. Now, the reason why we are frozen on infrastructure is because the revenue is missing. Therefore, I proposed that for every dollar of real cut, we match it with a dollar from the gas tax. The the gas tax should be increased to match dollar for dollar how much we get in real cuts. Even if you don't solve the deficit, you would get enough freedom of operation to allow the pooled interest board, which is the board that has authority over infrastructure projects, to authorize the start again of public works. That was paramount, and that's short term. Long term, I told you about the Gray Davis numbers. I found them fascinating. I didn't know what I was going to find when I did the data. So we have to constrain the rate of growth of spending. And one way of doing it is to say that two-thirds vote for the budget can be lowered to 50% if you don't increase spending more than population and inflation. That actually was very close to what we had in California in 1962. The assumption was if you want to spend more than 5%, you'll need two-thirds, but otherwise you can pass it with a majority. Another way is to restore the GAN limit, which we had until Prop 98. So it followed shortly after Prop 13 and then was undone in large part by Prop 98. The GAN limit said you can increase spending every year by the rate of growth of population and the price level, and no more. Constitution. We clearly need something of that nature because the political system has produced the year-in, year-out controversy that we've seen.
Elaborate a little bit. How much on the gas tax notion, how much would you push it up? How far could it go, and what can the state withstand?
For example, take the $4.03 difference from $2.25. So what was the gas tax? What was the gas price at the pump last summer? It was $1.78 less than it is now. And the interesting thing about the gas tax is that we know its effect on the economy because the California economy was actually still growing. Now, bear in mind, and you never ask your political colleagues to give you a break, but I can ask the Commonwealth Club to give me a break. If the quote out of my appearance in Lafayette tonight is Campbell loves taxes, you know, I'm doomed to being professor at Berkeley. Not a bad outcome, actually. If you cut spending, I'll match it with a gas tax, penny for penny, so that we can get the infrastructure flowing again. That was what I would propose. And the amount of money that I would be willing to offer on gas tax is exactly determined by how much I get on the savings side. The danger is if you offer the gas tax or any tax without cuts on the savings side, you lose your leverage.
Okay, so that dovetails nicely into the next question, which is where are the significant increases in California spending and why, and where is the waste?
Medical. So the budget is 40% K through 12, 30% medical, 11% higher ed, 9% prisons, 4% general fund goes to transportation, and everything else is rounding error. Now, K through 12, 40%, that's the Constitution. It's always going to be 40% or higher. That's Proposition 98. Are there economies? Sure, there can be economies, but you're still committed to spending the money. That's Prop 98. We, the people of California, adopted that. So you can save the money by being more efficient, but the savings goes right back into the schools. Not a bad outcome, candidly, if you get better rate of return education-wise for the same amount of money, but you can't put forward, I will slash the school budget and say you're going to balance because Prop 98 prescribes that it be 40% or higher. So the 30% healthcare. And here's how to change it. We have an entitlement mentality. We need to stop the entitlement mentality. And it's not heartless, but here's the difference between an entitlement mentality and how you'd purchase an item if you took advantage of your bargaining power. An entitlement mentality says we will provide more in Medi-Cal in the state of California, Medicaid system, than any other state of the union. That's what we do. Did you know we're the only state that has opted into every option under Medicaid? Every option. The federal government has a minimum and then it has options. And the federal government will match what the state does in Medicaid. And we come forward and we say, we'll do everything. And that's the entitlement mentality. So the population grows, and we're committed to covering all of those. Here's the opposite. Here's the reverse, and here's how we should do it. We have $30 billion to spend. That's it. We have $30 billion to spend this year. Healthcare providers, HMOs, PPOs, individual groups of doctors, what do you bid for the right to provide healthcare to the needy, the Medicaid, Medi-Cal recipients of California? You'll get a plain vanilla. You'll get a plain vanilla plus something else from one, and you'll get something to compare with from another. You'll get different offers depending on the region. Bid it with the announcement, we're spending 30. That's it. Give me the best medical care you can buy for 30. Reverse the entitlement mentality. That's where the growth has been. It's the fastest growing component of the state budget.
That's a sort of difficult sell sometimes, isn't it? I mean, you're talking about potentially denying health care to folks.
You're denying the most expensive, the fullest range, the complete suite of services that Medicaid provides. It suggests that perhaps we could go to a standard more similar to Illinois or New York.
Okay. Before we go further, I should say you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Tom Campbell about the economic imperatives for California and the country. Sticking with California, this is a question having to do with a constitutional amendment, which I'd like you to sort of focus on the constitutional amendment part of this for a second. The question is, would it take a constitutional amendment to stop paying the governor and legislators when they refuse to increase taxes to support a good educational system? My question to you in taking this is, if we were to have a constitutional revision commission or a constitutional convention, what are the things that really need to be fixed in California?
Two very interesting questions. On the first, no, it would not require a constitutional amendment. It would to reduce the salaries of judges, but they didn't include judges. So, no, that could be done by statute. And secondly, on the constitutional revision, if you wish to do it, I would go back to the system that says you should not increase by more than population and CPI. I would restore the GAN limit. And I would also attempt that 10-year, over a period of maybe 10 years, maybe faster, that one-year lag in revenue that I described. I think those two things would do it. And then you let the political processes work. I don't really believe that the initiative system should be used to supplant the legislature. I believe that it should be used to do what the legislature by its structure can't or won't do, like drawing its own lines. Well, this is almost comparable to that. So legislature, go out there and decide how much you want to spend for this category, how much you want to spend for that category, and how much revenue you want, depending on the tax levels. But you can't spend any more than you actually have as determined by the previous year. Or, and maybe both, you can't spend more than last year plus inflation plus the population rate of growth. Those are the steps I would take.
And did I hear you correctly earlier saying, though, that if there were parameters put on, you would be comfortable with a majority as opposed to a two-thirds budget vote?
Yes, if the parameters were that you cannot spend more than population and inflation increase from one year to the next. Bear in mind, though, I'd still keep the two-thirds for a tax increase. And the reason is pretty straightforward. In your materials, you can see the California tax levels. When I was finance director, I would occasionally be in the position of talking to companies contemplating moving out of state, and the tax levels were always an issue. The tax levels on corporations and the tax levels on individuals who work for corporations, who employees. So be very careful before you give up the two-thirds rule on taxes, or we will have more taxes. And you might say that's not a serious concern unless you take a look at the data, and here they are. We are the number one state in personal income tax measured by the highest bracket. That's the 10.3% for those who make more than a million. Well, you might say, well, very few people make more than a million. What's the real highest rate? Well, the next is for the 9.3%, and that puts us as number two in the country. How about our sales tax? We're number one at 7.25%. Oh, but New York City's more, sure, city tax. But if you do state by state, we are number one. How do you keep a business from going to Arizona when they have a 5% highest income bracket and a 5.6% sales tax? Or to go to Nevada where they have a 0% income tax and a 6.5% sales tax compared with our 7.25% sales tax and our 9.3% or 10.3% income tax? Or go to Oregon where there's 0% sales tax, Texas where there's 0% income tax. How about Massachusetts that sometimes comes in for criticism for being such a high-tax jurisdiction? Their state sales tax is 5%. Ours is 7.25. Their highest bracket is 5.3. Ours is 10.3. So, yes, keep the two-thirds for the tax. But if you're prepared not to spend more than inflation plus population growth, I would let the majority determine a budget.
One of the things you didn't put on your list, and I'm curious what your thoughts are, is term limits.
I'm not sure that's the right thing to do. And I supported term limits, and I thought that it would bring about a good result. And I'm only going to tell you, I've studied the data. When I left Congress the first time, I was on the faculty at Stanford, and I did a research project to determine how members of Congress voted in their last term when they knew they were in their last term. Some members of Congress don't know they're in their last term, but what? And I studied this question in order to find out. You'll find it, by the way, on the Berkeley website for the Institute of Government. I finished the work when I got to Berkeley, because I thought term limits. That's great because at least in their last term, members of Congress will vote their conscience. That a tragic sort of thought that at least in their last term, they'll do what's right. And then that would be a surrogate for deciding whether we should have term limits. And obviously we do have term limits in the legislature of California. I'll ask rhetorically, which do you think happened in the data? Did members of Congress who were in their last term vote more with their party or less with their party? When they knew they were in their last term, they'd announced their retirement. I'll tell you, just form your answer because I'll then tell you what I found. Form your answer. My suspicion was that in their last term, they would vote less with their party. They would be more independent. Statistically, significantly, the other way. In their last term, they're feathering their nest for their next job. And they want to be remembered as a loyal member of the team. That took away one of the principal arguments for term limits to me, which was that you would induce people to behave better, more independently in their last term. Indeed, you induce them to behave less independently in their last term. So that's why I didn't put it forward.
Very interesting. Question is there a way to measure and compare the performance of state of California workers and or departments with other states as a basis for measuring productivity?
Governor Schwarzenegger attempted this in his first year in office, and it proved to be quite difficult. I was not in charge of it. I came in his second year, and by then it had reached the end that the governor did not deem it feasible. So the problems they ran into is measuring output. Government is great at measuring input. How many dollars did we spend? Did you see people run for office saying, elect me and I'll spend more money for this? Or when I was in Congress, I put X more money, dollars into this. But it's seldom, if anybody, hears somebody say, elect me because we had better schools as measured by test scores, or we had better DMV service as measured by average waiting time. So I would like to try again, and if I do pursue the political route, that's an excellent suggestion to do.
Given the financial crisis we find ourselves in California, wouldn't it be prudent to cut back on the number of state commissions that politicians rotate through while awaiting their next run for public office?
Yes.
Let's go back to the federal for a second. This was an interesting question, I thought. And I think it's a question some people wanting to do the right thing sort of wonder. Should we abandon buying on credit altogether?
Should we abandon what?
Buying on credit.
Oh, gotcha. Right. What is the correct level of government debt? The answer is zero unless there's a crisis comparable to Second World War or the Cold War. So President Reagan and Tip O'Neill ran up a huge deficit, and the Soviet Union fell. Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Congress at that time ran up a huge deficit, and Nazism and Imperial Japanese militarism fell. And Lyndon Johnson said, "I've got a war. Let's call it the War on Poverty." and we got the deficit, but we didn't get the end of the War on Poverty. We didn't have a VP day. So the danger is, you can very quickly say, "Well, this is one of those cases." But the argument for borrowing otherwise should be limited to a project that generates revenue, which can be captured and pay for the bonds. So you can bond a tollway. And then the next step, well, why not bonding a freeway? Okay, I'll bond a freeway because a freeway will improve the productivity of the state of California. That will increase revenue, and I can capture it from the revenue. Just a little bit more loose. Easiest is where you have a tollway. But it's not a zero correlation. It is true. If you have better transport, you will have more productivity, more tax revenue. It can pay for itself. So what I would say is this, Dan. Be careful about going too far beyond that model, that you bond for something which will produce the growth in revenue that will pay for the bond. Or you bond when you have a threat to the existence of the United States, as we did in the Cold War and in the Second World War.
Let me take that same question, because it's interesting. You read that question differently than I did. I was wondering whether people personally, in terms of consumer credit, should abandon buying on credit altogether.
Oh,
maybe you're right in the way you interpreted the question.
Well, it depends, I guess, whether I'm offering personal financial advice tonight,
For the good of the country,
there's a role for the properly managed level of personal debt. How could Suzanne and I have bought our home? A mortgage would qualify under that question. So now we take out a little bit more than the cost that we needed to buy the home in order to buy a car. The issue is properly managed.
Okay, and this may be the last question. What investments do California and the country need to make? What are smart government investments?
The biggest one, I tried to foreshadow this in my prepared remarks, the biggest one is to lower the cost of hiring people. That's the biggest one. If I were to tell you green energy, maybe I'd be right, maybe I'd be wrong. I'd be wary of any government person saying, "I've got the answer. I know where the best investment is." But I would put my faith in people who are willing to risk their own money. And I'd make the government their partner by lowering the burden that we impose on them when they do so invest or when they do hire somebody. So consider it an investment when we lower the tax on investing. The government is matching your investment by a lower investment tax, by an investment tax credit across the board, by a capital gains tax reduction. Then the market allocates, the winners win, the losers don't. Money flows away from the losers and into the winners. That's how we got where we have in the United States today. Many people of goodwill disagree with me. I recognize that. People say, but look, we got so much from the space program, where you have the internet was originally a government project, and so forth. Pales in comparison with the private market. And I'd conclude by saying, do what you're good at. We can't out-Sweden Sweden. We are a nation of exceptionally different people taking the best from around the world, and each of them with an incentive to create will create. That's our strength, and that's what we should invest in.
Okay, very good. Our thanks to Tom Campbell, professor of business and former dean of Haas School of Business at the University of California, and economics advisor to the international law firm Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. We thank our audience here and on the radio. I'm Dan Bornstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.